following that beautiful talk by Chad this morning. But I'm going to be talking about a different aspect of scientific communication, not communication with the public, but communication between scientists and the role that some of this new technology may play. And it's helpful in a conference like this to say up front what my biases are. I'm a theoretical physicist. And I talk a lot to mathematicians. So a lot of my sort of view of the sociology of science is based on those interactions and may not be representative of science as a whole. But there it is. Having stated my biases, I will now feel at liberty to engage in them at will. So I guess from that point of view, it's not, and over here. So it's not surprising that the place where I sort of entered into this subject is the electronic ePrint archives. I hope this is a familiar screenshot to many of you. They actually predate the World Wide Web by a bit. They came online as an email-based interface. Very early on in the history of the web, they sprouted a web interface. I think there was a point, there certainly was a point I remember back in the days when all of the websites, the known websites in the world, were available from a pull-down menu in Mosaic. And I believe the archives, I kid you not, and I believe the archives actually made it onto that pull-down menu when it was, you know, within reason. That's known as a user interface that doesn't scale. We will talk about many things that don't scale. That's probably the most striking example of one. This is a something that did scale very successfully, I should say, and grew tremendously from its humble origins in 1991. It was really revolutionary. But in order to explain why it was revolutionary, you have to sort of understand what came before and how we did things before the ePrint archives. What you did when you wrote a paper was you sent it out to be Xeroxed, and then the copies came back, and they got stuffed into envelopes, and they got mailed out to on the order of 200 or so recipients around the world. Okay? Was both extremely expensive. I mean, everybody's research grant had tens of thousands of dollars per year allocated to preprint distribution costs. And nonetheless, since it was only going out to about 200 or so, you know, recipients, it was extremely limited in distribution compared to the potential audience. So what Paul Ginsberg did, and I'm sure he'll regale you with stories later in the week, is change this into something where the manuscripts were freely available from any internet accessible computer, it was so good that it essentially began to be seen as a potential replacement for the journals because it was both free vastly more convenient to use. No more trooping down to the library and pulling a bound volume off the shelf and then wrestling with the Xerox machine, right? You just a few mouse clicks and there was the paper right in front of you. Much, much better. It's also fast, not from the user's point of view, but from the author's point of view. You had less than 24 hours between when you submitted the paper and its worldwide availability. If you compare that to, you know, publication times in the journal or even the time it took to get those Xerox copies back from the printers, it's fantastic. There are drawbacks, and many of these were recognized right from the start. One of them is that the ePrint archives were unrefereed. This was not a problem when you thought of them as a medium for distributing preprints, which of course were unrefereed, but if you're thinking of them as sort of journal replacements, you might find that something of a problem. At this point, I like to invoke Sturgeon's law, which says that 90% of everything is crap. And you know, the refereeing process, at least in physics as I've seen it, filters out some of the crap, but it certainly doesn't filter out all of it. And there's no reason to expect that just because a paper has appeared in press in the journal, it's actually right. That's not true in mathematics, and this will be one of my sort of sociological points of contrast. The mathematicians take great pride in their published literature and work very, very hard to ensure that what actually makes it into print is actually correct. And so if you pull off some dusty bound volume and flip it open to a random page, you will find a paper that may not be interesting, but it's certainly correct. This is actually also has its downsides. What this means is that there's a very, very long lag time in terms of getting results into that published literature. And there's this whole sort of samizdat body of knowledge. Now, I go to my mathematician friends and ask them a question. They quote some result to me. And I say, well, where is that written down? And they say, oh, that's not published, but you know, everybody knows it. So that's one of the things that they sort of have to deal with, which is that if you're going to have this really reliable literature, you're going to have this whole penumbra of unpublished stuff floating around somewhere. The other thing that I'm probably more going to focus on in this talk is that the Ypres and Argres didn't change the product. They just changed the distribution mechanism. Okay, it's the same paper you were Xeroxing and mailing out. Now it's just distributed in a different fashion. Okay, haven't changed the quantum of scientific communication at all. You just changed the distribution mechanism. And so right from the start, people started talking about trying to build sort of a commentary layer or sort of overlay the archives, which would sort of fill in some of the perceived gaps. Among the things it would fill in, it would provide comments and corrections and feedback on papers, and it, to some extent, this would compensate for their unrefereed nature. You know, there'd be some alternate feedback mechanism present. I'd also like to suggest that these also provide a mechanism for communications which really don't fit into the format of a scientific paper. So let me give you a few examples. You'll see a lot of papers with titles that look like a comment on, or the inevitable a response to. Okay? And what those are forms of scientific communication which didn't really wish to be scientific papers, but were shoehorned into that format because that's the only thing available. Another thing, the most popular articles on the archives are review articles. Okay? You want to learn about some subject that you're interested in getting into, download a review article on the subject, and you know, you read it and you get up to speed. Well, there's a problem with that. If it's worth getting into, that means the subject is still evolving. Scientific papers are sort of frozen on the date of publication, which means that review article is rapidly becoming out of date. Okay? Something else that's unsuited to this particular mode of communication. So there are attempts to compensate for that. An example is Living Reviews, which is a sort of journal where of review articles which are being updated by their authors hopefully on an ongoing basis. There's another model that I sort of like, which is a sort of more wiki-oriented thing where other people can update things. But anyway, so that's another example of things that don't quite fit the conventional model. Another one is sort of back-and-forth discussions. I don't know, think about the Bohr-Einstein debates. Like that. I mean, there are lots of things which clearly are not in the format of a scientific article by any means, but which nonetheless are extremely important and useful, and you'd like to be able to communicate them in some fashion. And so on. I mean, we could spend the rest of the hour coming up with examples of things that don't really fit in the conventional framework. So there were lots of efforts to build such a commentary layer, and they all uniformly failed. Almost uniformly. And there are many reasons that one might cite for why they failed. There are a whole bunch of sociological ones. I'm going to try to pretend that the reason is technological because it suits my purposes. That's at least largely true, but maybe not entirely. The main technological barrier is that it's very hard to maintain a large, complicated website by hand. And the existing, what the pros do is they use a content management system to do that. But the existing ones were way too difficult to use and way too expensive because most of them were not free. And it was a real problem. There wasn't really a technical solution for managing these sorts of things. And if you were in my field or one of the allied ones, you notice there was very poor to non-existent support for mathematics. And that was a real problem. I point out here a notable exception, which is a sort of, it was never weekly, but an occasional online journal by John Baez, who will reappear later in my story. But really, you know, as I said, many people tried. They mostly all failed. In the 21st century, a new class of content management tools became available. They went under the name of blogging software. And their hallmark was that they were very, very easy to use. They were free and so on. And it became trivial, perhaps too trivial, some would say, but trivial to maintain a large, complicated website with dynamical content, user comments, trackbacks, blah, blah, blah. Became very easy to do. And so really opened up the possibilities which seemed to be closed before. Mathematics was still a problem, and I'm going to actually talk a little bit about the nitty-gritty of MathML. And so 6 years ago, I decided to take a shot at exploring this as sort of a venue for doing that sort of commentary layer thing that people had talked about but hadn't really been able to do successfully. I should say that this was really by happenstance. I was in a bicycling accident and broke my wrist, and I couldn't write for several months. But I found that I could type, so that was how I got into this. If that hadn't happened, I probably never would have done this. So this is the result. This is my web blog. This is a screenshot, I guess, from a while ago, but it changes. It's as I said, a research-oriented thing. It's mainly geared towards communicating with other physicists about matters that I happen to be interested in. And here's a shot of a page. You can see equations and figures and whatnot. The real deal. So on a sort of technical level, what I started with was very popular at the time, piece of blogging software called Movable Type. Which at the time, this was a mistake that I have subsequently not repeated. It was actually a proprietary piece of software. It's now been released under an open source license, which is much better. But at the time, I wasn't so bothered by it. The source was available, so you could tinker with that. But more importantly, I had a very nice plug-in architecture. And I figured all I needed to do was write a couple of plugins, and I could distribute those, and everything would work. As it is really a great platform. It's very well written and highly recommended. The other piece was a piece of software by a mathematician named Paul Gartside that I sort of took over, which converts some dialect of Tech, which is the lingua franca for doing equations among physicists and mathematicians and engineers and whatnot, into MathML. And I sort of took it over and beefed it up. Now, the trouble with this, which I didn't even realize at the time, as naive as I was getting into this, is that to actually use this technology involved sending your web pages. Let me postpone that for a second. So the, what's it good for before I say why it's bad? Let me at least say why it's good. The reason why it's good is that it was actually designed for putting math on the web. What people usually do, and still to a large extent do today, is if they want to put math on the web, what they do is they make pictures of their equations, and they stick the pictures on their web page. You know you can stick pictures on a web page. So you can make a picture of each one of your equations and stick it on your web page, and you have some semblance of content. But it has a bunch of disadvantages. It's not searchable. Pictures are just opaque pixels. It's not indexed by the search engines. It's not accessible. So this is there are blind people in the world. Blind people use the web too, but they don't look at pictures. And so if your content consists largely of pictures, it's not going to be meaningful to them. There is a plugin for Internet Explorer, however, that takes MathML and reads it aloud and does a pretty damn good job of it. It's actually a hard problem if you think about just take an equation on a page and you've got to read it over the telephone to your friend. It's not so easy to do in an intelligible fashion. This thing actually does quite a decent job of it. And it'll turn it into Braille if that's what the user prefers. Blind people maybe constitute that not that large a portion of web users, but there's a much larger portion of people who have varying degrees of visual impairment, which would be completely solved just by rescaling the text, making the font a little bit larger. Okay. Now, if you've got pictures, depending on what your browser is, one of two things happen when you do that. Either the pictures don't rescale at all, in which case it didn't solve your problem, or they do rescale and they look like crap. Okay, those are your two options. As a last point, which is sort of fancy, now we're in the age of Web 2.0 and dynamical websites, and there are all kinds of technologies that like cascading style sheets and JavaScript and so on, which this thing plays well with. And so I thought what I would do is just give you here's a screenshot from a mathematician's blog, Terence Tao. And this is hosted on WordPress.com. And it's the equations are produced by a completely standard package that they have installed there. This is kind of what you get, very typical. And you notice a few things about it. The equations are in this awful gray. And they're much larger, set in a much larger font than the surrounding text, which looks kind of ugly. It looks kind of ugly, but it's actually completely necessary. If it were set in the same size as this text, you would not be able to read it. Okay. And there's another thing which, because of that, you can't really see, but is nonetheless true. You can, for inline equations, you can never get the baselines to line up. That's a minor aesthetic point, but you know it's there too. It's a feature of using pictures rather than actual text. But as I said, the real problem with this comes about if you try to bump up the point size. Okay, because as I said, if you're lucky, the pictures will rescale, and then they look like that. Okay, just a blurry mess. So it's completely awful. Here is what it looks like redone in MathML. Okay, and the real payoff comes when you rescale the equations. Okay, really works. And you know, as an added bonus, what that means is that if you put your page on a fancy background, that also works. I didn't explain this. This LaTeX render, the thing that produced these pictures, produced blurry gray text on a white background. Okay, I didn't explain that, but I should have shown it. But it's blurry gray text on the white background, which would look awful with this kind of patterned blue background over here. You know, you have these white rectangles dotting your page. But anyways, that enough of that. Hopefully I've convinced you. So things were a little dodgy, actually being able to see these things 6 years ago when I started. Things have improved a lot. Since it's text, you actually need fonts. All of the symbols, there has to be a font with that symbol in it, otherwise you don't get to see it. And at the time, it was kind of catch-as-catch-can being able to do that. Now they're very high quality, freely distributable fonts with all of the symbols you'd ever want and some that you'd never want. The browser support is actually really good. I mentioned this plugin for Internet Explorer. The Mozilla family of browsers all have very good MathML support. The major gap, I would say, is in the WebKit-based browsers. So that means things like Safari and the iPhone. And since I wrote this slide, Google announced a new browser also based on WebKit. None of those actually currently support MathML, which is an odd thing given Apple's love for the education market. But there it is. The real downside came on the server side because, as I started to say and then thought better of it, you need to serve your web pages in this sort of special fashion where they're actually XML. And then you're subject to what's called a draconian error handling. So there's a certain class of errors where if the author makes such an error, the browser just bails and shows the user nothing. And unfortunately, all existing content management systems, and I really mean all, not just the ones I listed there, are not up to the task of producing well-formed XML in a reliable fashion. And so what I thought would be a couple of plugins to write turned into a lot of work, nearly 2,000 lines of patching the source code to this particular bit of software to really make it work in a reliable fashion. And I'm just going to skip it. There are various approaches to retrofitting existing software to make it work like this. And my thinking's evolved a lot in terms of how best to do that. But I'm not going to bore you with that. But what I will say is that in the future, none of this will be necessary. The next version of the HTML language, which is currently being worked on by the World Wide Web Consortium, will allow you to embed MathML and scalable vector graphics and whatnot directly. And so you won't have to jump through these hoops that you had to up till now. And I have to say I'm very proud. I played a very small but significant role in making that happen. Unfortunately, it's still a long way off. There are no existing implementations, and the specification probably won't be finalized for another decade. And you know, I don't know when that means it'll get into browsers. Yes.
They may have, but they didn't.
Yeah.
It is in the specification now.
Whether it's in there 10 years from now when it's finalized, I don't know. But you know, it got in now, which is cool. So, yeah. I don't know. I can only say. We won one battle. That's
best I can say.
So I clearly I'm not a good test case for how this all works. I ended up becoming sort of an expert on this sort of esoteric stuff. That's maybe not very representative. Fortunately, I also host a few other blogs on the same site. This one down at the bottom here is sort of moribund. It was a blog run by a bunch of physics postdocs. The one above it is quite active currently. It's run by three mathematicians, one of whom is the aforementioned John Baez. Here are some rough statistics from, I don't know, about a month ago. It's a significantly large site all of which is perfectly reliably, you know, well-formed, blah, 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 with, you know, tens of thousands of comments and whatnot. All works very nicely. And the main thing is that the authors neither know nor care about all the esoterica of the past half dozen slides or so. They just, you know, type their equations in some simple dialectic tech and, you know, use very simple markup, and it all just works. That's the way it should be. So I talked about this commentary layer. I talked about these blogs. How does it fit together? And this, again, is sort of a technological answer. One of the ground rules that Paul Ginsberg set, not just he, but since he's not here, I can blame everything on him. was that any such commentary layer was not going to be hosted at the archives. It was going to be completely independent. So hooking these things together was a bit of a challenge. I spent about 3 years bugging him to implement trackbacks at the archives, and eventually he did. And the idea is the following. Whenever someone writes some comment on some paper on the archives, a little link appears over here on the abstract page for the corresponding paper. When you click on that, you're taken to a page listing all the places where such comments appear. And if you click on one of those, you get to the blog post itself. So you have an immediate way of knowing what's been talked about and finding what's been said about each paper. There is now, I think, a thriving ecosystem of blogs in mathematics, much less so, actually, than in physics. Much more so than in physics. You find, in fact, Fields Medalist. I already showed you Terry Tao's blog to make fun of the typesetting, but I mean, he's a Fields Medalist in mathematics. So is Alain Kahn and Tim Gowers. They're all blogging. You know, the Fields Medal, for those who know, that's the Nobel Prize in mathematics. Okay. You've got graduate students. You've got our aforementioned N category cafe that I host. There's a rich ecosystem of mathematics blogs where they're talking seriously about serious mathematics, much more so, as I said, than in physics or, to my knowledge, by any other scientific field. And part of the reason is something that I mentioned before, which is that because of the very stringent nature of their literature, they have much more need of some alternative means of communication for all of that stuff that isn't yet in print. So they really need this commentary layer much more than we do. And also, they've learned to reward these alternate forms of communication much more than we in other fields of science have. So an example is the math SciNets, math reviews is the sort of thing where these people actually are credited for putting out information not just in the form of scholarly papers, but in these alternate modes. So with that, background, they were much more readily took to, I think, the blogging medium as a medium for scientific communication. If you look at the history of the archives, you find a similar phenomenon that I'd like to suggest, namely that different subfields picked up the use of the ePrint servers at vastly different rates. High-energy physics, well, happens to have been the first, but other fields with a similar preprint culture, namely ones where you sent your papers out to be Xeroxed and then mailed them around, were much quicker to take up using the archives than fields which didn't have that pre-existing preprint culture. Because after all, you were doing the same thing you were doing before, just in a different distribution medium. Same thing here in mathematics. If you're doing the same thing you were doing before, just in a new medium, it's much quicker to pick it up than if this was not an accustomed practice in your particular subfield. There we go. The commentary layer sort of predisposed them to blogging. So I learned a few things from this, and maybe I should tell you what I learned from the past few slides. One is that whatever software you do, it really has to be open source. It has to be freely distributable. It has to be really, really, really easy to set up, because nobody wants to fiddle with hard to set up stuff. And you also need to have a really good sort of user experience. So one of the things that I'd really like to see is MathML and WebKit, because there are a lot of people using it. And there are a bunch of other things which, if we had an abundant amount of time, I'd get into. But what I'd like to turn to now is a sort of different aspect of the same problem of scientific communication among scientists, which is collaboration. So if you collaborated with anyone remotely, you're probably familiar with the following scenario. You do some calculation, you type up some notes on it in a little tech file, you email your collaborator the notes, he, you know, responds with his own little tech file, and it goes back and forth, and pretty soon you have an email box full of tech files, and you can't find anything, okay? Which one contains, you know, the corrected version of the calculation, you know, all we're doing, you know, which one has that clever argument, you know, for neglecting certain graphs. Do you ever sort out that minus sign? And if so, where is it sorted out in this stack of email? It's a horror. Everybody, you know, the room is divided between those who are smiling and nodding their heads and those, what's he talking about? It really is a horror, I promise you. And it's the result of using cutting-edge technology from 25 years ago. I mean, email, tech, those are 25-year-old technologies, and damn it, we've come a long way since then. Or as I like to say, 25 years is a very long time in internet years. So we really need to start using, you know, these antiquated technologies and start using something slightly more modern. So there are a few things that obviously suggest themselves, which actually work very well. Rather than emailing around files, you can use a shared file store like WebDAV, or you can use a version control software to keep track of, you know, the various iterations of some calculation. I mean, the computer programming community have figured out how to do version control and have very nice programs for doing that. Both of these things work really great, but more at the manuscript preparation stage rather than what I like to call the knowledge accumulation stage. You know, this is when you have a fixed thing and you're trying to write the paper. Very good to have, you know, version control and share the, or a file share or whatever. But when you're actually trying to puzzle things out, I think what I'm going to suggest, what you really need is something that looks more like a wiki, but one where you can do math easily. And so about a year and a half, a little more now ago, I decided to write one. And this time I you know, again, I'm not really into writing these things from scratch. So I took something that was pre-existing, which I would adapt, and I started with something that was open source. And built Ruby on Rails, for those of you who don't know, is this web frameworks that all the cool kids write their web 2.0 applications in. This was not exactly, directly amenable to what I wanted, but was easy enough to customize the way into a fashion where it could reliably produce XML and MathML and whatnot. Reliable fashion. Because it's open source, I took various other open source things and mixed them in, including a markdown interpreter, the aforementioned text to MathML converter, various other things. And so I'd like to explain a little bit about why this is a good thing for collaboration. So the first most obvious thing is that you can the password protected areas. So I have one little wiki for each of my collaborations. I should say So I have one little wiki for each of my collaborators with a password for my collaborators, because after all, I do want to keep my mistakes from the prying eyes of the whole world. On the other hand, when you do have something that you do want the world to see, you can publish a read-only version of it, if you wish, which can be read by anyone, but only modified by those with the password. It, of course, like any wiki, has a full revision history with redline documents between different versions and the ability to roll back changes if you don't like them. It has file uploads if you have, you know, a Mathematica program that, you know, you want to upload to this wiki, you can upload files. Full math support, And most important of all, when you finally get to the stage where you want to write the paper, you don't want to start over from scratch. So this thing has one button export to LaTeX. And I've written two papers and a grant proposal using this. You press a button, it spits out a LaTeX file that you paste into your paper template, and it's pretty much ready to go. Okay? But it works really amazingly well. As I said, I've written a couple of papers and a grant proposal. I didn't get the grant, but that's not why. But it really does work nicely. And then, you know, so what happens next? So you write the paper, you send it off to the archives, you start getting seminar invitations, you know, to come and give seminars. And again, you don't want to start everything from scratch. You can do presentations using the same wiki software. This presentation, for instance, is all done in that software. And it comes with a built-in, built-in variety of different themes. You can't see the one. Oh, it's terrible. But this one is the last one. Somehow it's cut off. Comes with a variety of themes. You can easily make your own. And it all just works marvelously. So we're doing an arm. I'm fast. So I'd like to end with a few conclusions. So first of all, you know, I think it's, well, and Chad gave a wonderful talk about communicating with the public. I'd like to suggest that at least as important is the ability or the prospect of changing the way we communicate with each other. And I've tried to show you a few tools for doing that. Anytime you have a new medium, this enables new forms of communication. The ePrint archives, as a sort of paradigmatic example, were not conceived of originally as a journal replacement. They turned into one because it just worked for that purpose. Many of the things I've talked about here and the sorts of communications we're beginning to see, I don't think they were conceived in any sort of grand scheme for where they were going to end up. But I think that anytime you have a new medium, it enables new forms of communication, some of which you anticipated, some of which you didn't anticipate. And I think that's very exciting. I've already talked about different rates of uptake in different fields. The ones, you know, which sort of were predisposed to looking at alternate forms of scientific communication are the ones that adopted it most quickly, both predisposed in terms of doing it, but also predisposed in terms of rewarding it. Chad talked about rewarding outreach efforts. You also, I think, if you're going to take seriously sort of alternate modes of scientific communications, if you expect people to actually do it, you somehow have to reward that as well. As an example, I gave the mathematicians who sort of already are doing something along those lines. So even though different fields take up these new media at different rates, they all seem to eventually get around to it. Even fields in which the archives were very, very slow to be taken up, are now, that is the primary means of communication. Even though at first it didn't look like they were going to be. So I firmly predict that the same will be true of these other modes of communication. The World Wide Web was invented by high-energy physicists, high-energy experimentalists, I should say, precisely as a means of communicating with each other. Okay, it was a distributed information system for high-energy experiments. Okay? It subsequently changed a little bit, but it's time to actually return it to its roots, I contend. And so I guess there I will end a little bit early, but good enough.
So there are much more time for questions than comments. Yes,
please. Does Google index MathML in any sensible way?
Very interesting question. The problem of indexing is a very interesting one. So
There are lots of different variants on a word. So I can give some examples. Munich with a capital M or a small M, with an umlaut or without an umlaut, and so on. The search engines know to recognize those all as the same word. Okay? So you have a similar problem with equations, depending on exactly how they're expressed. Okay? The same equation may have different string, correspond to a different string of bytes, okay? But they're all the same. And so search engines have to know that they're all the same. So there is a project, an NSF-funded project, by the same guys who brought you the Math Player plugin for Internet Explorer on mathematical search. Okay. And so they've done very interesting stuff. And what they do actually is they take sort of different things and canonicalize it, because that's the way Google works too. They canonicalize it to a particular form in MathML, and that's what they index.
So are they actually building a separate search engine there?
Well, they're building a search technology, and so right now it's just a little search engine of mathematical text. You know, I think they index Wikipedia, you know, my blog, you know, various other things with, you know, heavily mathematically oriented text available. But in principle, this is a technology that could be incorporated in other mainstream search engines. Google, as you know, has a lot of interest in indexing academic stuff. You know, there's Google Scholar and so on. So they're very interested in doing this. The technology is still not really excellent. But that is one of the things that you want to be able to do, I think, to make this stuff useful. And it's definitely a matter of ongoing research.
So you've just completely blown my mind and answered my entire Christmas wish list.
Oh,
that's awesome. Two questions. First one is, I want to start using it now.
5 minutes. I'll give the URL for my website. And before the next speaker has gotten through his third slide, you can have it installed on your laptop isn't there. You can have it installed and running on your laptop. Let me back up a sec. It is definitely an under 5 minute install on Mac OS X, Linux. I have never installed it on Windows. I hear it's been done, but I would love to know, like, have detailed instructions, because I have detailed instructions for the other operating systems, but not Windows. It's absolutely trivial to install, and you're up and running almost immediately.
After you've created a wiki page and you want to go back and edit it,
yes,
do you edit the MathML or
iTech? No, you edit the iTech. Yeah, so it's, I mean, I can.
So the fact that it's using MathML is.
That's just for output. I mean, that it's not a very human friendly format. It's a machine friendly format, which is good for machines. But it is just iTech. In fact, if I can do this, let me see. I can show you the source for this. Where are we?
So what's it stored as? It's stored as iTech or MathML?
It's stored as iTech. Okay. And convert it to MathML on the fly.
Okay.
I guess what I'm trying to do here. Well, I may have to do it afterwards. I'm going to show you the source for this slideshow.
iTech is a pretty limited subset of logic, isn't it? It doesn't do arrays the same way.
No, it does actually. It has all the array environment. It has matrix, p matrix. There's a list, and the advantage of being the developer is if there's some LaTeX construct that I find I want that isn't there, it's trivial to add. So it gets a lot of, I've gotten a lot of feedback from users, you know, hey, there's this LaTeX construct that I'd like to use, you know, could you add it? And yeah, sure, why not?
So I have a question about, I guess, about barrier to entry. So I have a math blog.
Right.
And I discovered a plugin by a fellow named Ron Frederick, math publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issue I ran into is that my blog and a lot of people's blogs are hosted on some Linux server where we don't have the luxury of just installing LaTeX on the server. I assume that's a barrier to...
Well, that's not a barrier here because it doesn't use anything installed on the server. You don't need a LaTeX installation. You don't need any of that. iTeX MML is very, very fast a stream filter that just takes your, the stuff you type and converts it into MathML, on the fly. And so I can't speak to everyone's hosting environment, so I don't know what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. I do know, for instance, that there are that there are people with that there are hosting services which, for instance, allow people to install, say, movable type or WordPress,
right,
or whatever.
If you have that, then
this thing doesn't go through a system installed LaTeX installation. And by the way, that's just horrible because if you look at how much CPU time LaTeX takes to process, it's I can see why hosting services don't let you do that unless you're paying them a lot of money because it really is very process intensive.
You're saying I can take my self-hosted WordPress blog, which I have on some, HostGator or somebody's hosted Linux.
I used to have a plugin for WordPress, an iTech MML plugin for WordPress, and I kind of got fed up and stopped supporting it way back around version 2.0 or something, which is embarrassing. But it's still there if you want to bring it up to date so it works with the latest version. That would be great. But there are other problems. Doing that. I don't know. You both pick one. What?
How portable is it? Because
Well,
your little Ruby on Rails wiki project, right, that you're talking about. You said it's very easy to install.
Mm-hmm.
I've been using, and Garrett as well, been using TiddlyWiki.
Right.
For basically the same purpose, and that's a single HTML file.
Right, so TiddlyWiki, for those who don't know, is an entire wiki written in JavaScript, and it's sort of a self-contained, So this is not that, this is hosted, if you will. It's a piece of software that runs, and the text is stored in a database, and so on. It, as I said, is very trivial to install and has zero setup. So it is much easier than I think any other wiki software except TiddlyWiki, which is completely standalone and completely self-contained.
Yeah, and the great beauty of TiddlyWiki is you can just keep it on a USB drive and take it and plug it into any computer you like. You just got a web browser and Java.
Well, JavaScript is great. It's great that way. It's not even Java; it's just JavaScript. So this is not that. Your computer will need to have Ruby installed, but everything else. So I don't think it uses any external. You have to install iTeX MML, and you have to install the package itself, and that's it. Everything else is self-contained. It doesn't rely. It comes bundled with Rails. It comes bundled with its own web server. You're up and running. You don't have to have a web server. Comes with its own built-in web server and so on. But it does require Ruby installation.
You may try like commenting on those mistakes already. It seems in a sense that actually what you're providing really would enable people getting
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As I said, if that's what you want to do, you just don't set a password and it's visible to the world.
That's why do you know of any examples
of what you're doing? I think the closest to that is one of the people on that N Category Cafe blog. I would say a lot of his posts are almost stream of consciousness. Here's this idea I had while walking for lunch. There it is. So, there are certainly people doing that sort of thing, not necessarily in a wiki sort of format. I wasn't trying to denigrate that sort of open model for anything. And you do what you like, but here you also have the possibility of, you know, doing things sort of privately as you so desire.
The idea of using MathML and these technologies is great. How does this can play? How well does this can play with the existing installed base of MediaWiki content? A lot of math.
There's a huge amount. So this is interesting, and gets into a subject that I don't know all the internal politics of. There's a guy, last name is Harvey, and I'm forgetting his first name at the moment, who wrote a clone of, so Wikipedia is one of these services where, in fact, every equation is a picture, as I said, makes sense. But he wrote a clone of the piece of software that turns your equations in Wikimedia into pictures, which can, at the flip of a switch, instead produce MathML. It's called BlaTeX, and it again, you know, you can find it on the web. It's sort of very similar to iTeX-MML. They have not quite exactly the same, but certainly largely overlapping dialects of tech. And so his idea was that, you know, he would write this thing, and when the time was ready, they would just swap this in and swap out the thing that they're currently using, and everything could be, you know, rendered in MathML instead, and would have some of the advantages you saw on the slides I showed you. For some reason or another, the people who run Wikipedia did not take kindly to his suggestion, and so it exists, but it certainly has not been adopted by them. I don't know why. As if there's some internal politics there, but such a thing exists, and it would be much better because when you do get indexing of equations, as I said, you know, that's sort of an ongoing research project. It will work much better to have it in MathML. So, yeah. I don't know why people do that. Yes?
What other disciplines or communities have adopted your software, your system?
I don't really track that well who's using it. I mean, there's a page on my on the InSticky Wiki software website, you know, where people who are using it, at least in some public manner. I mean, I know they're just based on, you know, hits. I mean, there are a lot of people who are using it, you know, either as personal note-taking things or for collaborations, but not necessarily in some publicly available format. And so there's a guy in Colombia who's writing an online quantum field theory text using this. That's fairly ambitious. I mean, there are a bunch of other, you know, computer science people who are using it, and various other people. It, you know, in terms of, you know, what you, piece of software you choose to use, the main selling point here was the fact that it does math in this very nice fashion. So I'd expect that the natural target audience would be people who are interested in doing that rather than something else. You know, the ease of installation story was very important from my experience with previous attempts at this, but it's probably not the selling point. Maybe people choose that.
And an opposite question or a reverse question. Have you had negative feedback within the community?
I mean, about
this particular
about the software or about the time I spend blogging? I've certainly had a bunch of that, but you know, I mean, I've got 10 years. So.
Yeah, I mean, the conservative established.
No, it mostly comes from young people.
Oh,
well, I mean, they're the ones willing to tell me, you know, that I really should be, you know, writing more papers, blogging less. But I don't know. You know, I think that you know, again, there's a real question of you know, seeing value to the community and deciding that, you know, that's something valuable. And different communities are certainly in different places in terms of seeing that. Whether you're doing public outreach or whether you're doing, you know, things geared more towards specialists, you know, there's opinions vary as to how valuable that is.
I mean, leading by example, I think, is one of the best.
Well, look in mathematics. As I said, I gave you a list of Fields medalists who are active bloggers. So, you know, it's certainly possible. There's no reason.
Well, I'm very interested in the political, social, academic dynamics involved with the diffusion of innovation. Mm-hmm. When you have something as innovative as this, that's being used by, you know, some major players in the field, one would expect that there'd be less criticism of this alternative by, you know, the general community. Is that too much of a jump?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's always sort of, you know, a chicken and egg thing. I don't want to do this because nobody else is doing it. Or conversely, you know, I think, sure, it certainly helps that in math there are these prominent examples. Very prominent mathematicians doing this. They weren't, however, the first, and they're certainly not the last. You know, but it certainly helps in terms of making it acceptable to see, you know, prominent people doing it. And I highly recommend all prominent physicists in the audience doing it. But, you know.
Well, again, there is a larger question too. I think that's a major theme of this conference is, to what degree do you, as an innovator and a tenured faculty and risk taker, affect the larger scientific community as being an example of the benefits that can accrue by individual initiative and implementation, and then subsequent adoption of something that's a better tool for your discipline, for your profession?
Yeah, well, I can say, you know, that I happen to know that, you know, many of the sort of self-serving leading lights of the field actually, you know, read my blog, even though they don't necessarily write their own. And, you know, I have gotten feedback about things I've written from, you know, well-known people in the field. I mean, it certainly has an impact there. And I, very interestingly and somewhat mysteriously to me, it's also, you know, has an impact in terms of public outreach, because I know all the science reporters are reading these blogs, and you know, you talk to them, and they've been religiously reading this stuff. You have to scratch your head and wonder, why the heck are they interested?
Well, it may not necessarily be formal, but certainly it's becoming quite viral, and will continue to be quite viral when blogging is.
You know, blogging is the new black.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I actually sort of recoil a little bit against that, because I don't want to, as far as I'm concerned, the way I phrased it here is that this blogging software is just a tool. Okay. It's a, you know, easy to use content management software with some, you know, restrictions, but basically that's what it is. And what you do with that tool is a completely different story. I mean, if you wish to call it a blog, fine, you can call it a blog. But the point is, it's a tool for communication, and there are many different kinds of communication you can engage in. And so, you know, don't let the name pigeonhole the product and say, you know, this is what it's good for, and not something else. It could be good for many different things. People use it, you know, for their courses. They say, you know, let's have the students all, you know, interact via this piece of software. and that works too. Right? And there are many things you can do with the technology once you recognize that it's, you know, useful for one thing. Maybe it occurs to you that it's also useful for something else.
Okay. I think it would be wonderful that that ended early, so that has lots of time for this very animated, very useful discussion. We should take a break and spend more chances to talk to the talk. Make another